Good afternoon.
Never say never, but it's...
I'm Michelle Amazine. I'm in the Department of Mass Communication, Advertising, and Public Relations. And thank you very much for attending the Spring 2019 Distinguished Lecture, which is part of the Dr. Melvin L. DeFleur Distinguished Lecture Series, sponsored by the Communication Research Center at Boston University. Today we are truly honored to have Dr. Joseph Thoreau as our Spring 2019 Distinguished Speaker. Dr. Thoreau is the Robert Louis Cheyenne Professor of Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication. He is an elected fellow of the International Communication Association and was presented with a Distinguished Scholar Award by the National Communication Association. A 2005 New York Times Magazine article referred to Dr. Thoreau as probably the reigning academic expert on media fragmentation. In 2010, the New York Times called him the ranking wise man on some thorny new media and marketing topics. In 2012, the trusty Internet Privacy Management Organization designated him a privacy pioneer for his research and writing on marketing and digital privacy. Dr. Thoreau's research focuses on digital cultural industries, especially at the intersection of the internet marketing and society, as well as studies on database marketing, media and privacy, digital out-of-home media, the process of innovation in the mass media, and the relationship between media and the medical system. Among his many, many other publications, he is the author of The Daily You from 2011, which many of my students have read. This book explores how the contemporary advertising industry is increasingly defining one's identity and worth to society. Most recently, Thoreau has released a report, Divided We Feel, about the growing use of surveillance in society, implications for privacy, and how people feel about it. Please join me on behalf of the Communication Research Center in warmly welcoming Dr. Joseph Thoreau.
Thank you. I really appreciate everybody coming here today. I got to turn this on.
It is on.
Oh, it is on. Okay. Yeah. Good. Thank you. I thank you. It's amazing. You guys are sitting in the first row. Nobody wants usually to sit in the first row. It's like a principle of things, but that's okay. I can see everybody anyway. Thank you. I'm going to talk about some stuff for about 35 minutes or so, and I hope you have questions, then we can open that up. But if anybody has a question about what I'm saying, if you don't understand a particular thing, raise your hand, and I'll be glad to try to, what do I do? I should turn it on? That's what I thought. You said it was on already. It's not on.
Okay. All right.
Now it's on. Now it's on.
It's on.
So, as I said, if somebody is interested in a question about what I'm saying, feel free to raise your hand. I'm going to talk for a couple of minutes about the overview, the arc of where I'm going, so that you'll know where I'm heading, and I'm going to go fairly quickly because there's a lot to cover. As it says here, a resignation industry is developing in tandem with and overlapping with the growth of the digital interactive media system. The resignation industry carries out pervasive and purposeful corporate activities that have the potential of corroding political and cultural democracy. That's my argument. And we need a sociology of digital resignation to understand that industry. Research in this area is best carried out with a new understanding of the meaning and nature of media research, and I'm going to try to explain what I mean by that and make the case. This whole thing, my interest in this area, started with some research we did in 2015, where we tried to explore what I thought was going on in Americans' heads. The issue was the following. Marketers kept saying that the reason people give up their data, there's something called the privacy paradox, I don't know if you've heard that. It's the notion that people are willing to give up so much of their data for small amounts of things like discounts, while at the same time they say they care about their data. And people say, what's going on? And mainly marketers were saying, well, what's going on is people are basically not being honest with themselves or others, And rationally, when it comes down to it, they're seeing that there's a trade-off in giving out their data for the benefits they get. And I was talking to people and in regular life began to think there's something wrong here. I kept hearing that people kept saying it's futile. You know, I'd like to get off Facebook, but gee, all my friends are on Facebook. I can't do anything about this. And so what we did is, as part of a survey in 2015, you know, I can't go into all of it, we gave people two questions, part of many statements that they get. These two statements were not together, and they were randomized by a polling company that called people on the phone. It was 1,500 people, 75% wire, cell phone, 25% wireline. So it was a major polling study. And the two statements were, one was, I want to have control over what companies can learn about me online. And the other was, I have come to accept that I have little control over what marketers can learn about me online. And that's, together, those two represent the definition of resignation. Resignation being, according to the Google Dictionary, wanting something not to happen but knowing that you can't, or wanting something to happen knowing you don't have control over it. So in 2015, 84% of the people agreed with the first statement, 65% to the second. If you look at people who agreed or agree strongly with both of them, it turns out that it was in 2015, 58% of Americans were resigned. And we did the same thing just a year ago, the same statements, again, randomized and all that, 63%. So around the same percentage of Americans felt that way. And so given this, what does that mean? Who cares? The argument here is resignation to commercial surveillance can be a vehicle for undermining political and cultural democracy. As I say here, a key feature of cultural democracy involves assuring people they have equitable access to cultural resources that enable them to feel they can participate actively in community life. And by that, I mean all aspects of community life. We talk about the public sphere in America. I would argue that a major part of America's public sphere is shopping, going to the mall, all right? That's what Americans do. They buy stuff. And walking around a mall, whether it's online or in a mall itself or in Macy's or in some other store, and feeling that somehow you're not getting the same break that other people are because of a profile that a company has about you, can affect how you think about the nature of the market, how you think of your place in society, how you think of society itself. And in the book, The Aisles Have Eyes, that came out about a year and a half ago, I talk about the industrial logic of 21st century marketing. If you go, again, I can't go into the whole thing about this, but it turns out if you look at the history of selling, about in the US and Europe as well, until around 1850, 1860, the dominant form of selling was peddling, right, and small merchants. If again, very briefly, those people had to deal interpersonally with the people they were selling, and usually they did it based on stereotypes. People were sold goods based on what the peddler thought he could get away with. They usually had in the product they were selling some mark, some code that told them how much they had paid for it, and then they were negotiating based upon the person, based upon the network that person was part of, they gave different prices. Also, they showed people different things based upon what people, what they thought people would buy and what they could get away with. That changed in the 20th century. The 20th century, and it's a long story but a fascinating one, was about the democratizing of purchasing in interesting ways. You had posted prices. We take that for granted now, right? You go into a store, price are posted. You have the ideology that people should be able to see everything, even though they didn't always. But that was the idea, that you walked into a store and you saw everything anybody else saw, whether they were wealthy or not. You go into Louis Vuitton. No one's going to stop you from seeing the Louis Vuitton stuff, even if you can't afford it. And the prices are there. Okay, that was the ideology anyway. The argument that I was making in the book is that that's changing. Because in the 21st century, you don't get to see all the same prices. Right? Most of you know that when you go online, and sometimes, as I can talk about, even offline in the store, the prices are different. You may see different things. A lot of people see different things when they go to different websites, different apps, because of the structure of what the company knows about you. Okay? And that changes the dynamics of what it means to participate in this level of public sphere. And so I argue that the industrial logic of 21st century marketing points to substantially weakening that assurance of equitable access by institutionalizing surveillance and profiling. The activities in marketing create a hidden curriculum that naturalizes all sorts of surveillance. By hidden curriculum, which is a phrase that George Gerber picked up from people who were studying the education industry, hidden curriculum means that we learn how to do something, that we learn the values of doing something without being explicitly told. And the hidden curriculum of the 21st century, I would argue, is that to get along in the 21st century, you have to give up your data. And there are many ways in which we learn that in a non-explicit manner. And that's part of what I'll be talking about. Resignation is part of that curriculum. The next part of the argument is that resignation is not an accidental byproduct of 21st century life. It's rather a purposeful strategy on the part of commercial interests. And we could talk about what purposeful means. I don't mean that executives sit around and say, we're going to make Americans resign. But the structure of the situation leads to that. It, to forestall collective public anger at what Zuboff, Shoshana Zuboff, who was at Harvard, following others call surveillance capitalism. The notion being that it's better if people are resigned rather than angry. Okay, angry people do stuff you might not want them to do. The digital resignation industry is comprised of a regularly interacting conglomeration of organizations that work to cultivate resignation among media audiences. It's marked by a rhetoric, what I call a rhetoric of obfuscation. And what I mean by obfuscation is obscuring intended meaning in communication by making the message confusing, ambiguous, and hard to interpret. Okay? Now, Helen Nissenbaum uses the term obfuscation in a different way in a book that she wrote with somebody else, in which they argue that what people should do is obfuscate themselves, hide themselves from companies. I'm not using that that way. I'm saying that companies use obfuscatory strategies to confuse people when it comes to what they do. And I'm going to give some examples of that. I'm going to be talking about placation, diversion, jargon, and misnaming. Okay? And these are examples of how companies obfuscate. And I'm going to use not Facebook or Google or any of the standard kind of whipping people of privacy. I'm going to go to Kroger. Anybody ever been to a Kroger? Okay, it tends to be in the Midwest, but they own Harris Teeter on the East Coast. They own Ralph's on the West Coast. It's the second biggest grocer in the United States. What's the biggest grocer?
Amazon.
Well, no, it's Walmart.
Yeah.
But Amazon's moving up there. Okay, so I'm going to be using the Kroger privacy policy to talk about this kind of stuff. Placation means to appease or pacify, especially by concessions or conciliatory gestures. This is the privacy policy of Kroger on the first page. And it says, your trust is very important to us. That's why we aim to be clear and transparent about why we collect information, the information we collect, how we use the information, and the choices you have regarding our use of it. We can also collect, use, and share aggregate or anonymous data that does not identify you. We collect that information to save you time and money to make your shopping experience better. And then they have a video, this I got a number of months ago on that site, where they have employees from Kroger telling you that they care a lot about you and they care about your security and privacy and thanks for shopping at Kroger. But if you decide, despite this assurance, to go into the main part of the privacy policy, you begin to see a very different story. Okay? It says, in an effort to provide you with relevant content and offers that may be useful to you, we may partner with third-party companies to display content, offers, or advertising tailored to your interests based on how you browse or shop online in our stores. Okay? Then it says, and typically privacy policies start with assurances, and then be hoping that you won't read further down to see what they really are doing. Then it says, these third-party companies use non-personally identifiable information, okay, such as browser type, hardware or software information, cookies, session ID, time or date, click screen information,
Then they say, they may also collect and share personally identifiable information, such as static IP address, okay. Then we may provide your personal information to third-party companies that display person-based or interest-based ads. In addition, others, advertisers and ad networks, ad serving companies or other social providers, may infer user interest or purchase history based on interactions with or clicks on personalized ads or content. So all of a sudden, that level of assurance that you got with the placation doesn't look so great. The second is diversion, which means the act of straying from the course. And this is the main page of Kroger. And you can see that in order to get down to privacy policy, even if you're interested, you have to pass these delicious dishes. And another common tactic, which I have to say is part of the Federal Trade Commission requirements that you should also talk about security, a lot of companies conflate privacy and security. And, you know, they say, we really try really hard about security, and people may think that also means privacy. It's not clear that people know the difference that much. And as I say, the presence of privacy policy at the bottom of the homepage. The misnaming is kind of a riot, because the misnaming is the name privacy policy. It turns out that privacy policy is a really problematical term. And we have done research since 2003, a number of studies, actually this 2018 is in there as well. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 separate studies that we did in Annenberg, and then Pew did one copying sort of our stuff. And the main idea is phrased somewhat differently, but basically the true-false sentence was, when a website has a privacy policy, it means the site will not share my information with other websites or companies without my permission. How many people think that's true? Well, you're right, your communication majors at Boston University. Believe it or not, over 50%, sometimes well over 50% of Americans don't know the answer to that question. It's astonishing. Every time I do it, I say, well, maybe now they'll know it, you know? But this one was in an article that just came out a few months ago in the Journal of Broadcasting and Electronic Media. For the purposes of that article, we took out don't know. But a large percent of Americans don't know the answer. They say we don't know. Americans don't like to say they don't know things. But even in that, they'll say don't know. So, and it's consistent. And Pew found it as well. We keep finding that. So that the idea of even the notion of privacy policy is problematical. The term. In fact, I've been saying for numbers of years to the Federal Trade Commission that given that this finding is consistent and no one disagrees with it, you know, no marketers or anybody disagrees with it, if a company fits that characterization where they do these things without your permission, except it's in the privacy policy, maybe they shouldn't call it privacy policy. Maybe they should call it how we use your information. But no one has picked up on this, because I think companies realize it's confusing, which is fine, they think. Okay, and related to that is the idea of jargon. By jargon, I mean special words or expressions that are used by a particular profession or group that are difficult for others to understand. Okay, and Kroger doesn't have as much obvious jargon as you might think. Some websites are impenetrable. And they try their privacy policies try to explain in quotes by having links that I call sort of rabbit holes. You know, you go one link to another to try to understand what's going on. But the Kroger's not bad until you realize that it says almost nothing. Okay? So they say, when you connect to one of our websites or mobile apps through a third party, we may collect information from their website. For example, if you choose to associate your social media identity with Kroger Company, the site may provide us with certain information from your social media account. Okay? Then they say, this may include without limitation. Okay? What does that mean? You know, lawyers are involved in this. User ID, interactions with our posts, certain demographic information. What does that mean? Other information shared with us based on your account settings. What does that mean? Then they say, we may also gather information about you from other sources, including consumer research firms and public databases. What does that mean? You know? And so, really, they're saying we can take anything from anywhere. And if you want to read a really interesting privacy policy, which is not that unusual, but I love because it's named, it's Target, right? Read the Target privacy policy. They say this, and they go even further. We can buy information about you, we can use information about you, anything. But most people don't look at this stuff. But so this is a case where there are these convenient phrases that broaden the possibility. They seem like they mean something, but if you really try to understand it, they're almost meaningless. Now, everybody know what the GDPR is? Yeah, it's the Europeans are trying to create a better sense of privacy. As you probably know, in Europe, there's a sense that privacy is a human right. Here, the idea is it's sectoral. It's by sectors. So you have HIPAA on the one hand with physicians. You have financial regulations. In the marketing arena, it's pretty well been wide open. The GDPR tries in about, last I read, 275 pages in English anyway, to have criteria that make more transparency and allow people to get data that these companies collect about them and a whole variety of other things. But I'm skeptical that at least in the short and medium term, we're going to find many changes. I think it's going to be litigated. I think that already there are law firms supported by public advocacy groups that are trying to question what these things mean. But in the meantime, I don't know if you've been to Europe or countries that relate to the GDPR, and I have some examples here that show that this stuff is not really changing very quickly. So, for example, one thing that is fascinating about this is from the Telegraph, it says, basically, they're supposed to give you specific information about what they do with your stuff and if they have third parties that are relating to your data. And here they say, we use cookies to collect and analyze information on site performance and uses to enhance customized content and all of that. And they say, okay. That's it. No decline. If you want to find decline, you have to figure it out by clicking on cookie settings and going to a lot of places. That's not in the spirit of the GDPR. Related to that, and this is a fascinating entry into what I think companies are going to start doing, there's this term in the GDPR called legitimate interest. And if your company has legitimate interest in using data, if it's supposedly clear that you can use it, you don't have to get the same level of permission from customers. And so in this one, they say, the Telegraph, other uses of your information are made for ordinary and transparent purposes, which we think are necessary for our legitimate interests as a provider of news, content, and other services. And those legitimate interests include third-party cookies and other things like that. So they're bringing the notion of legitimate interest directly into these third parties, arguing that they don't have to show you the third party. They don't have to. Normally, the idea would be that if you're using third-party cookies, you have to tell which companies are doing it, what those companies do with the information, and get people to check it off all the time. And here they're saying, we don't have to do it as part of our legitimate interest. Whether they get away with it in the long run, there are attempts to say, this is not legal. People have been challenging this in court in Europe, but it's going to take a while. The really funny thing about this is that the Interactive Advertising Bureau in Europe is doing the same thing. You know, they have been trying to help advertisers figure out how to navigate this new terrain. And in doing it, on their own site, they are doing things that seem to be directly against the spirit of the GDPR. So here it says, IAB Europe uses cookies for functional and analytical purposes. Some cookies used by third parties may be used for targeting advertising purposes. And they just say, I agree, you know, without any discussion of what those third parties are about or more information or read our privacy policy. This is another one that was, I thought, really pretty funny once I figured it out. It's a company that says, you know, because of GDPR regulation, we want you to agree that we can do these things. Look at putting first-party cookie in your machine and look at how you get track whether you make certain decisions or not. And at the bottom, it says select all and save, or save current choices. See? Now, first of all, select all and save sounds like you're getting a bargain. Save, you know. But anyway, they're hoping you'll push the button. I was looking at this and said, this button is whited out. I can't push that button. It's a fake. You can push that button. I was looking at that button for about 5 minutes, and finally I had to go, because I didn't want to hit select. I wanted to not have them do this. If you push the button, you can do it. They make it seem like that button is unpushable because it's whited out. So there are these new techniques that companies are doing to try to fake people out when it comes to even the GDPR. All right. Now, creating media research frameworks for exploring the dynamics of resignation and its implications means rethinking our understanding of our field. That's where I'm going here. You know, I've talked about the obfuscation that companies are trying to do, whether and possible reasons for why we found this kind of resignation. And now I'm going to talk about what it means for communication research to think about this kind of stuff. And I'm going to argue it really means rethinking our understanding of our field to begin to think about this. There have been a number of traditional propositions about what communication research, mass communication research, or media research is about. One traditionally is that media exercise social power through storytelling. You know what I mean by that? Always interested in, and it's really important, newspaper stories. Newspapers tell stories. News programs tell stories. Stories on Netflix. And of course, people have historically been interested. What are the effects of that? What do they do with us? What stories do people tell on Facebook? That kind of thing. The second is that storytelling's role is to create a superstructure that reflects the economic base. You know, that there's that historically people talked about that, the superstructure and the base, and that really Marx said that the media are the superstructure of society. They reflect what the economic structure is about, and storytelling is the superstructure that helps to reproduce the society. And the notion beyond that was that these stories are forms of mass communication. So entirely divorced from whatever responses people would have. What I mean by that is when I was a kid, when I was an undergraduate, certainly a graduate student, the one thing they told us was mass communication meant no feedback, right? That you can't talk back to television set. That you can't talk back to a magazine, unless you're a little loony, right? But and so that was a principle of what it meant to study media back in those days. And it related then to this larger idea of storytelling and how companies found out about the reactions that people had to the stories was typically through ratings or circulation, things of that sort. Now, even by 1983, scholars such as Raymond Williams and Dallas Smize were questioning some of these assumptions in ways that were presaged by Frankfurt School philosophers like Adorno and Horkheimer, not in 1984, more like 1948. But the idea was that there's not necessarily a distinction between base and superstructure, and the media are engines of society just as machines in factories might be. Abdallah Smythe had this argument about audiences that contradicted this truism that audience members couldn't immediately interact with mass media. He created this idea that the audience was working for media companies. And when I read it back in the, I guess it was the 70s, I thought, that's kind of strange. I don't quite understand that. And the notion was that audiences are participating in the media economic activity by working for advertisers, by watching the commercials and things like that. But in some ways it was prescient because that's what people do now, right, on the internet. And in fact, they're interacting all the time in real time. Even in the 70s, talk radio did exist, and the spread of interactive cable showed that immediate responses to mass media and their auditing of audience commercial labor were possible. The notion that popular media had no ability to garner immediate audience feedback, as I just suggested, was demolished 2 decades later with the advertiser-sponsored internet. Okay, so now today, this notion that we can't somehow immediately get feedback doesn't exist. But that changes a lot of the way we ought to think about what's going on.
And I'm working here from a paper I wrote with Nick Caldrey about this that was in the Journal of Communication. The deepest implications of these developments doesn't concern the labor which audience members work, like being labor on Facebook, you know, where you're writing things. Facebook couldn't exist without you guys writing on it, or Google, for example. But rather, it concerns audiences' role as resources for value extraction. That is, as entities whose information can be used or sold by companies for a profit. What I'm talking about here is the industrial construction of audiences and their use by companies, okay? But I mean by industrial construction, audiences don't exist, qua audiences. You are individuals. Right now, I'm thinking of you as an audience of people who are supposedly interested in listening to a lecture about media. Why? Because I'm getting reinforced for that. They invited me, they said it was a nice lecture, you know, it's all this kind of stuff. But that's how I'm constructing people. You know, audiences are always constructed. And in media context, audiences are industrially constructed. And so what we're talking about here is not stories that are told to audiences, but stories that are told about audiences. And that the internet and other digital media are preeminently interested in real-time understanding of audiences in terms of construction. But we want to go beyond that. What advertisers wanted, however, was not audience feedback, but surveillance. The opportunity to record individual audiences' behavior with media. The internet fundamentally changed how this could be achieved. What's distinctive about this latest approach to the audience is that it involves not simply finding customers for goods or services, but creating data profiles of individuals, which enable sorting them as more or less valuable to add to sellers, okay? So that companies increasingly can profile you with a score. And that score determines whether in a particular context you get a higher or a lower rate. I've talked to some advertisers who say that they give loyal customers more, they charge them more price, a higher price, than non-loyal customers, because they're loyal. They'll pay the price. Okay? And today, I don't know if you realize this, you can walk, and we can talk about the particulars, you can go in front of a, walk down a supermarket like Kroger, and stand in front of the diapers, and it'll change the price for you, because it knows that you just had a kid. And as a consequence, maybe one company thinks that you're valuable, given the history of your shopping there, and they'll support giving you $2 off this particular kind of diaper. And they'll do that by sending a message to your phone with the discount. I mean, it's interesting. I was, years ago, when they were trying this type of thing out in a more primitive way in the supermarket near my house, they had kiosks. So I slid my frequent shopper card in, and I got $2 off a liter of Coke or something like that. So a person came over to me and he said, "I see you got a Coke thing off. Can I have yours?" He wanted the discount. And I wanted it too. I was going to use it to buy Coke. So I said, "I'm sorry." But it turns out he probably couldn't have used it anyway because they connected to your frequent shopper card. And by the way, the frequent shopper card is a fascinating thing. One of the things I learned when I was working on this book, The Aisles Have Eyes, is that one of the most important inventions of the 20th century was the barcode. Just think about it. I mean, the barcode, and we can talk details later, changed the way companies organize their activities, and it certainly was the beginning of companies learning who we are in a systematic way. And it was invented by two graduate students at Drexel University, interestingly enough, in 1948. So at heart, this process that I'm talking about through surveillance is, as Ashkar Gandhi suggested, social discrimination. Literal discrimination, meaning I'm separating you from somebody else, but also then arguing that this can have social effects by you're more valuable than I in a systematic way to a particular company. Culturally significant though they are, technologies involved in the targeted presentation of media stories represent today only one facet of how audience construction and social power are converging with a larger transformation of Western business, okay, often linked to government, toward massively enhanced capacities for surveillance. It's not just storytelling anymore. It's lights. It's thermostats. It's how companies tell stories about us through other than just stories. Okay? The purpose for business, what matters is not the link to narrative transmission, but rather the underlying transformation of the internet into a space of continuous data extraction through surveillance. Okay? So that whatever you do, you are connected in a way that a company can talk to you. Anybody been to Disney World with a magic band? And I don't mean a bop, 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 bop. They put a band around your arm, and the company can figure out exactly where you are as you move around constantly. You know? And it is amazing amount of data for Disney to use about how the people there work. You can go through the park. As Bruce Schneier said, the business model of the internet is mass surveillance. In this world, the term media content can't be limited to narratives that the communication field has traditionally studied. You know, we looked at news, still look at entertainment, advertising, other storytelling genre. These are very important, don't get me wrong. I spend half my life studying this stuff, half my professional life. But beyond that, we have to realize that it also has to include the broad gamut of data that are critical for a different kind of storytelling, the discriminatory profiling of individuals and groups that companies carry out. Okay? And that relates to how we use the phones, mobile personalization, shopping. Shopping is really important. You know, when I started doing this stuff about supermarkets and department stores, some of my students laughed at me. But, you know, people, as I said, shop, and knowing how companies track us online and off, and even that distinction is getting crazy. I keep saying there's no real, the distinction of online and offline doesn't make sense anymore. Okay? The Internet of Things relates to this. The home as an advanced terrain for tracking, which is a fascinating topic, how companies over time have made what was always a porous home into a place where now you can bring things in and out. And voice as a leading edge of biometrics, where companies are trying, like Alexa, you know, and Google Home, are trying to understand you and even biometrically understand you through your speech. There was a recent patent that Amazon got, without going into too much detail, where their ability is to, by what you say, understand your emotions and even whether you're sick. So Amazon, the cartoon on the patent says, Alexa, what should I have for dinner tonight? And Alexa says, how about chicken soup? You don't sound well. And then the woman says, no, chicken soup, not chicken soup. Thanks anyway. And Alexa says, well, how about aspirin? I can get you aspirin within 2 hours. And she says, that's a great idea, thanks. So it's a totally different way of what it means to talk about things. Often unrelated to the production of tales for audiences, the media involved in these new narrative activities have hardly been studied at all by communication researchers. Here in this place, in BU, they've done it more than many other places. New marketing and data processing developments mean that while the term media may continue to attach to the distribution of narratives, researchers must now conceive it as the convergence of message circulation technologies with data extraction and analysis techniques that are linked to everyday objects, increasingly typical of our new mobile personalization era, where we're walking around with a phone, it's part of our life, and you're pinging data like crazy everywhere. Ignore these wider infrastructures of communication, and we'll miss the transformation of social and economic order and control that's underway today. And digital resignation is an integral part of this process. Digital resignation is the process that keeps the data analytics engine going by cultivating a vision of reality that makes surveillance, surrendering data, profiling, and discrimination based on that seem natural in the 21st century. How exactly does this process work at macro, meso, and micro levels, and the combination of the three? And how has that developed historically? To what extent do the terms agenda setting, cultivation analysis, and digital divide have new resonances for this terrain? Can we make sense of it in this new arena? How do we understand approaches now to hidden curriculum, normalization, socialization? you know, when we realize that kids are teaching their parents how to use Alexa. Teachers are beginning to talk about using the phone in ways that normalize surveillance. To what extent and how are traditional media content genre used in new ways as bait to encourage us to release data, like locational data, biometric data, emotional data, about ourselves? The societal stakes in developing this expanded research agenda are high. The massive increase in data production, processing, and profiling depends on activities of continuous surveillance, which are fundamentally in tension with the basic freedoms on which democratic processes depend. Worse, they may undermine the basic levels of trust and legitimacy on which civic, economic, and political institutions depend. If you keep wondering what underlying what you're doing is leaking, and to whom, and not just to the stores, but to the government and other features of society that they're trying to control. As academics, we're in a privileged position to illuminate these tensions critically and so contribute fundamentally to society's understanding of an economically driven transformation of the very nature of the social order. And I'm hoping that our field, because, you know, what's happening is the engineers are into this, the lawyers are into this, okay, and the business people too, to some extent. There's a danger that communication will be left behind as a field, because these are topics that so many other fields are getting into. And the trick is to try to bring ourselves into that picture, to show what communication people can contribute to this kind of discourse. Thanks for listening. So, no stones, no bananas, no tomatoes. Anybody want to ask a question?
About 15 minutes for questions.
I'll start. So, you know, a privacy policy in some sense could be thought of as a contract.
It is, yes.
It is, right? So, most people are pretty good at assessing risk and protecting themselves in a contractual situation. You think about buying a home, the risks are very high. You might even hire a lawyer to review your contract. Even in a first home, people will hire lawyers to review contracts. It just seems to me that given that people are pretty good at assessing risk, the fact that they perceive these contracts as no risk is a function of the fact that nothing very much happens as a result of their signing the contracts. In other words, they do all this stuff, and in their real world lives, there's really not a whole lot of consequence. And I've read your book, I've read Schneier's book, I've read Julia Angwin. You guys all really struggle to find real world examples where real harm takes place. I'm not suggesting that I don't want privacy. I'm a big fan of privacy. But the problem is, for most people living their lives day to day, they just don't perceive the problem.
Right.
So,
well, I think if you look, they see it. The word that comes up a lot is creepy. Okay, and what I have learned to understand what creepy means to most people is I don't like it, but I don't quite understand it. I think that's what creepy means. I got a piece of the Times of doing something now on invasive, which it seems that I got a questionnaire yesterday from a person from the Times who was sending this out, like ranked types of privacy, supposed invasiveness. And I didn't quite know what invasiveness means, invasive to whom, see, and a lot of other aspects of it. I totally understand what you're saying, Marty. The issue is, this is the beginning of a long-term, I don't want to say trend arc of society, okay? If we want to talk about the history of marketing and in terms of 20th century, we're in 1890. Okay, in terms of that, not 1999 or 2000. If you look at what I mean by that is, this stuff is going to only grow, and the kinds of tendencies that we're going to see that we're seeing now, I would argue, are going to become part of life in more discriminatory ways down the line.
I'm not disagreeing. I agree with you. I'm trying to ask you the question.
Yeah.
You know, you've had all of this testimony before Congress. You've got all of these books published. You've got all
me.
Of this.
You're talking about me? Yeah.
Not you. No. One has.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering what catalyzes the public to care about this as a public policy issue. Everybody uses this stuff all the time.
Right.
I mean, creepy, usually when something is creepy, the behavior stops real fast. I mean, people get very concerned about it and you know, call it out.
There's a phrase about this that I didn't make up, which I think is very apropos to this. It's called seductive surveillance. Okay? How many people have an Alexa or a Google Home? Okay? It's coming up to 30% of American society at this point.
Okay.
So I use it. I think it's terrific. But do I really need it? I don't think so now. But right now I'm giving Amazon credit. I literally don't know what Amazon is doing with my data. Literally. Okay. Probably nothing at this point. But let's look at the Chinese social credit system. But it's using the same approach.
Okay.
And there is nothing to say why. Everybody know what that is? The Chinese social credit system? Okay. It is using the same approach. I was just in China last summer, and people are shrugging, okay? They're resigned to it there. And I think that's a much more specific example of harm that's taking place. And you have the same response because people feel they can't do anything about it.
We could debate that one for a bit more, but I'm just going to stop.
Okay.
I think a student had a question.
Over there. No, I think that's a great. I think this is a critical question. Okay, and I don't have an easy answer. It's not simple. Yes.
Thank you for the illuminating.
That's always a dangerous.
Yeah, that's always
preliminary. Yeah.
Watch out. I know this gentleman to my left used to work in private industry.
Yes.
And his concern.
But a good private industry.
Well, private industry. And I would. The concern of many of his colleagues, as I understood it, was that they're in business to make profit, and we collectively benefit by the taxes that they make, especially those of us who have public education, which people here probably haven't. And there are many other good things about what we can do with tax money. So they're very interested in making money, which benefits society. And parenthetically, we have some great plans for their income and profits in the future. But they're just looking for ways to make profit in ways that are ethical and not illegal. Would you say not just, but that's a major dimension of their activities? And so tapping into this has some substantial benefits for these companies. Otherwise, they wouldn't be investing in it in anticipation and harvesting the data. And you as a consumer often benefit because they're able to more efficiently provide you with things that you would like and not waste your time with things.
Yeah, and I'm not against personalization, don't get me wrong. I'm not against targeting. What I'm against is the use of all of that to create profiles that are not transparent and that are potentially discriminatory. So that the horse is out of the barn, and I'm not suggesting we go back to 1955 or anything like that. But I am suggesting that there have to be ways to rein in some of these activities, because as I see it, there are cycles of personalization that are taking place. We're in the against what I'm doing now with this voice business. We're in a second cycle of personalization that really begins to bring biometrics into the story. Then the next cycle is going to be facial recognition on a daily basis, together with voice. Who knows what the next cycle after that is going to be? And it is a matter of how much do companies have a right to know about people, and to what extent do people have the ability to stop that?
Those are good questions. I guess I'll just make 3 points and then we can turn it over to someone else. But first, you mentioned 1955, and of course, if you look at privacy surveys from 1955, there was great concern about Social Security numbers. Anyone also, by the way, who knew his or her Social Security number in that era would be considered a freak, for it's such an odd thing, whereas today, everybody knows that number. And yet, the very same concerns that you're addressing, including political freedom, were very prominent then. And as the professor to my left indicated, the alarm has been going off every few years, and there's greater freedom now in the United States in terms of personal lifestyle and preferences than there has ever been before. So you have the policy concerns, the civil libertarian concerns that you raise, which are serious, I don't deny. But you have this other dimension where people are running wild in the streets, figuratively speaking, from the perspective of 1955.
Right. The last thing I'll say before we open it up, I was giving a talk, I guess it was a year and a half ago, at Ryerson University in Toronto. And a person in the audience who looked like a mountain man, had long hair, a long beard, he raised his hand and he said, "You know, I've been off the grid for decades." He said, "I have never used a credit card. I don't have cash. I always use cash. I don't have a frequent shopper card." And that was terrific. He said, "Now I need a loan and nobody wants to talk to me." And, you know, it's the kind of thing where there are consequences to what we expect from data. You're absolutely right. In 1955, people said, "Don't spindle, mutilate." They were upset about a little later than that with the computer cars and the fact that companies would tell people, "Don't bend the computer card because we need to use it about you," and people were resistant in that. But, you know, I think that the issues today are darker. I think the ways in which companies can track people are tougher. And I think the punishment for not fitting in is going to be also stronger. And that's, you know, we'll see. I hope I'm wrong. But I get paid to be a critic. I mean, the thing about it is that, if I were working for Amazon or Google, I would be doing exactly what they're doing now. I'm sure of it. I'm fortunate enough to be able to have a salary where I can try to point out something a little bit differently. And that's, you know, I think that needs to be done so the other side gets heard. Yeah. I'm not trying to say that I'm better than anybody else in that regard.
So let me just close with one point, and that is in my own research on privacy. When you ask people in a free form, what are they most worried about? It's not governments, it's not corporations. It's what the neighbors know. They don't want the neighbors knowing the salary. They don't want neighbors knowing what's in the garbage, how many wine bottles, are they expensive wines, are they cheap wines? That's the big fear that people have.
Well, essentially,
not to downgrade the others.
I haven't asked about neighbors, but I do find that people are more worried about companies than they are about government. Whether they should be or not is another question, but that is what we find consistently.
Thank you very much. That was a great, fascinating talk. I totally agree with you, and I feel like there's another layer on it about companies collecting people's data. There's an argument about all the internet companies were essentially turned to data companies because they are collecting.
Yeah.
We don't know what part of our data collected will actually specifically use for the functions that benefits us. So they're probably collecting data that are not really useful for the specific service, but they're using it to sell to a third-party company.
Yeah, well, how many people here, when you download an app and it says, "Can we collect your location?" hit OK just by very nature of it? Most people do. And if you think about it, most of the companies that are asking for that don't even need you they don't even need location. What they're doing, of course, is they're selling your location to companies that do that market you in terms of the data. And location marketing is a fascinating business, but it also has the ability to track where you are. And we shouldn't assume that this stops at marketers. I mean, the ability to hack into this stuff and governmental agencies and others can figure out where you are down the line and use some of those data. These are very much porous activities across different sets of the world. So.
But on the other hand, basically the audiences or the users actually don't have enough ability to resist that. I was actually wondering if they, the examples you just raised, if they have disagree there, what would happen next if you click on the disagree?
You would go through, I've done that, you'd go through, again, a rabbit hole of discussion, mm-hmm. which some, at least in the American context, tries to assure you that you're kind of an idiot for trying to do this. Mm-hmm. But in the other one, they'll tell you something more about it, and you can eventually find a way to decline. Okay?
Yeah, but like, when I was actually using ResearchGate to download some papers, and I kind of disabled my cookie settings, and I wasn't able to download a paper.
Yeah, so companies will sometimes, right. They'll do that. I believe the new California law, correct me if I'm wrong, but the new California law says that even if you decline, you still should have the ability to use the site. But that's going into effect in 2022, and people are trying to change that already. But yeah, there are lots of conflicting and perplexing questions that I think most people I know who are not, it's hard to keep up with this stuff. You know, why should people be able to do that? It's interesting, Pew found that that most people don't even recognize that Facebook gives them choices about how to fix up the kind of privacy restrictions they want. And then they ask people to go and look at what Facebook knows about them. And when they did it, they said, yeah, that's fairly accurate. But they said, we don't like this, you know. So, yeah, and of course, people don't like it, and yet they don't want to pay for a lot of stuff. So there are a lot of dilemmas that we're facing within the society about it. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I guess I'm just wondering, thank you very much for your time. Were there differences among demographics? I'm not sure if I missed that, about how people interpret privacy.
I'm trying to remember. I think we found that it didn't vary by age. Interestingly, it didn't vary by age. It didn't vary by gender. Oddly enough, we found some small differences that were significant. African Americans tended to be less resigned than whites and Asians, but they were still large. It was over 50%.
I wondered mostly just about, you know, more privileged populations perhaps being more resigned because they don't necessarily feel threatened by, you know, those in...
Well, you know what we did find, and this was a surprising thing. The more we gave people questions about how sophisticated they were in understanding this, the business of marketing and media, and we found the more knowledgeable a person was, the more likely they were to be resigned, which is really interesting, and it was surprising to me.
I wondered a little bit about income as well.
I don't remember income. I don't think it mattered, but it's real hard to get real income well, even in major survey research projects. Yes, sir.
Sorry, actually.
Oh, sorry.
I was wondering, in particular, and building off Ian's question, whether how this idea of resignation balances with the instrumentality of having data. Like, I know, I like to think that I know what data is being collected about me, yeah. But I'm usually fairly enthusiastic about it because I'm a nerd, mm-hmm. and I like having a bunch of data about me that I can do interesting things with. And, you know, the idea of having people control at a really granular level the data that's collected about them and whether they want cookies on different sites is, I think, a valid one. But there's also, like, things that you can't do without collecting data about people. And so even if you simply say we should have data autonomy, doesn't that still create an imbalance where the people who are willing to autonomously volunteer information about themselves will have increased capabilities or increased access over
That's an interesting point. I don't buy the idea that the reputational society possibilities are good ones. There are companies that say, we will take hold of your data and we'll get companies to pay us for the use of your data. Sort of reputation companies that are trying, that's not caught on very much. Yeah, I agree with you that there are advantages, hidden problems with any kind of situation where you give certain people autonomy because other people won't have it. There are like hidden implications. I think that most people, there's an incredible number, and I haven't seen this collected, of urban legends about how companies use people's data. You know, like if I want to get a good airline price, I should go to a friend who never used that airline, that kind of thing. May be true, maybe not. There are lots of these legends that people use, but in actuality, it's very difficult to figure this stuff out. And so I when people say give people control over their data, I used to believe that that kind of thing was a good thing. Now I'm beginning to think that maybe regulation is the most important aspect of stuff, and then maybe and transparency should be important as well. But you know, it's not easy in this environment to do that. And I, as I suggested, I don't even think the GDPR is successful at this point. So it's a tough situation. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for the talk. So, as a room full of communication scholars and students, what can we do?
No, right. You're asking the tough question. My wife always says that to me. And the problem is, you know, I wish if I could answer, I just suggested that I think more than I ever thought before that regulation, the one thing I've been thinking about, the answer is, if I knew, it would be terrific, but I just don't have an easy answer. We're living in a world, as people here have suggested, which the seduction of certain kinds of data are useful for people. And it's very hard, and companies know what they're doing, they really do, but when they're seducing people this way. But I think one of the things that we could think about is limiting the number of data points that companies should be able to use about us at any one point. One of the problems that you get into when it comes to data is the idea that there are sensitive data and not sensitive data. And with artificial intelligence and machine learning, all data can be sensitive. So that I could look at what you buy at Kroger's and come up with conclusions about your lifestyle and your longevity that might really impact the way I deal with you or sell your ads to insurance companies and things like that. And that kind of meaning that can be yielded means that anything can be sensitive. So I'm thinking that possibly the one way to limit the use of artificial intelligence like that is to limit the number of data points. Then you have to figure out what that really means. And can you do that and all that? But as I say, targeting, quad targeting can be very useful. The New York Times recently, because of fears of GDPR, decided not to target by third-party knowledge in Europe. And they just targeted by region, like by country. And apparently they did better than they thought they would do, even better compared to the year before in terms of the, you know, when they actually had good micro-targeting. So it may well be that we're overemphasizing that sometimes. You can't compare the Times to some other website, some small website in programmatic advertising. It all goes back to John Wanamaker, okay? Now, Lord Lieberman, or different, one of them said, and we talked about this last night, that 50% of my advertising is wasted. He said, I know 50% of my advertising is wasted, but I don't know which 50%. The history of the 20th century and the 21st century is the desire to figure that out. And people thought that the internet was going to be the solution to that. Through interactivity and personalization. It turns out it isn't at all. And so what ends up happening is we're upping the ante toward biometrics now to be able to get to that point. And we're doing more and more, and it's going to be up the ante, just to answer that question. And it's not an easy answer. We're never going to get it. It's a holy grail that's so far away. And yet, in the end, it's affecting the way companies deal with us. So there it is.
Well, questions, we're going to go to reception. So if you want to ask Dr. Jordan, you can. But
thank you for listening. I appreciate it.